Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The huge broadcasting company Clear Channel is now known as iHeartMedia. We'll talk with the CEO, Bob Pittman, about what that means for the future of radio.
But first, a team from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is in North Texas today to help prevent the spread of Ebola. Officials say the paramedics who transferred the first known case of Ebola in the U.S. have so far not tested for the virus. Public health officials are not releasing the man's name or nationality because of privacy concerns, but they do say he is critically ill and he's been in isolation since Sunday at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. Lauren Silverman is with KERA Public Radio there in Dallas. And so, Lauren, how are people reacting to this news? First Ebola patient diagnosed in the U.S. is in Dallas.
Well, people are alight. I mean, Twitter and Facebook are on fire right now with mostly misinformation, unfortunately. There's a lot of rumors that are being spread. And most recently this morning, there were some media reports about a possible second Ebola case. But so far, Dallas County officials have said that that is not confirmed. There has not been any second case confirmed.
Yeah. Well, let's walk through the timeline. This man arrived in Dallas from Monrovia, Liberia on September 20th. He came to visit relatives. The CDC says he didn't have any symptoms and therefore he was not contagious. We're reminded Ebola is not airborne. It's only spread through body fluids when someone has symptoms. So when did he first develop symptoms?
That's right. So he was tested before he boarded that flight for they test temperature. And that's one of the giveaways of, you know, many different illnesses. But that includes these strains of Ebola. He began having symptoms on the 24th, from what we know. And then a few days after that, on the 26th, is when he came in to Texas Health Presbyterian for the first time. And he was looking for medical care. He didn't feel well. We don't know the details of his symptoms. But this is when the sort of controversy begins because he was sent home after that with antibiotics and he did not remain in the hospital.
Well, how are people reacting to that? Because, again, he took himself to the emergency room. He had symptoms of Ebola. He had been in West Africa. And we understand that the hospital had just ironically had an Ebola meeting that week. And hospitals are being told, you always ask people where they traveled from. And so obviously something was missed here.
Yes, that's what the hospital now is having to look into. They say they're going through the checklist to try and understand what happened. It doesn't seem as if they had asked the question of where of his travel, although the hospital hasn't confirmed that. But usually that is part of the protocol for checking for infectious diseases, particularly when they had just been briefed on Ebola. It seems like a logical step to take to ask, well, where had you been traveling? But we don't know the details of why, if that question was not asked.
So meanwhile, we know the protocol now is that health officials find the people he came in contact with. What's happening?
Yeah, so the CDC now is really going to get its chance to shine, and epidemiologists whose job it is to really understand the spread of infectious disease. And they have lots of techniques for looking into the details of who this person came into contact with. Of course, his family members, and then, if necessary, the people who, for example, he might have been in the emergency room with. You have to start to look at, basically do a family tree to figure out who is at highest risk of having contracted the virus from him and start there and extend outwards. But this isn't something that you do over a period of a day. You can't check once and then check them off the list and say that it's all clear. This is something that is 21 days long because that's the period of exposure for Ebola. So they have to monitor these people for now a period of 20 days. And if any of them show signs and symptoms, obviously send those samples in to get tested for the Ebola virus.
Now, then that could be a wide range. I mean, are they saying if you were in this emergency room on this day, or how are they doing that?
No, they are not. There have been no sort of mass announcements of that sort. They're really just starting with the closest family members and going from there. Of course, there are regular announcements that are if you have any symptoms, I'm sure that there are more people showing up at the emergency room concerned about whether or not they have a common flu or something more serious because the symptoms are not very they don't look very different from the common flu. You know, you wake up with aches, you may have some diarrhea, you may have some other high temperature. So it's hard to tell what you have. And they are still saying, though, if you have any of those symptoms, that you should go into the emergency room and at least get monitored and checked for anything more serious.
We're hearing from top infectious disease people like Dr. Anthony Fauci that they are – while this is serious, they're not concerned. They feel that they will contain this completely. Is that the message that's being sent out there in Dallas?
Definitely. Health officials here and at hospitals across the country really are not as concerned about this as I think the general public may be. The situation in Dallas and Texas at the hospitals in terms of protective gear, protective clothing, mm-hmm. and the situation within the actual hospital is so different than anywhere in West Africa right. that it's really not going to be a major concern here.
Lauren Silverman of KERA in Dallas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The broadcasting company Clear Channel, which owns more than 850 radio stations in the United States, has changed its name to iHeartMedia. So what does that mean for the good old-fashioned radio business? Bob Pittman is CEO of iHeartMedia, formerly known as Clear Channel, and he's with us from New York. Bob Pittman, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, what was wrong with the name Clear Channel?
Well, nothing was wrong with the name Clear Channel, except I think we just outgrew what it meant. I once ran a company called Warner MX Satellite Entertainment, and we decided one day we should change the name to MTV Networks because we had a product that everyone knew and they had no idea what Warner MX Satellite Entertainment was. And I think we've sort of gotten to the point with Clear Channel where, although it was a great name and, you know, been built over decades, that people thought Clear Channel meant something in the past and iHeart meant something in the future. So I think we decided to go with the future, and we also had become so much more than what Clear Channel had been that we spent a lot of time. We'd say, oh, yeah, no, Clear Channel. And go, no, now we're this and this and this and this. So we said, you know, I think the name is just not doing us justice at this point.
When you say something in the past, are you talking about radio? Because that's the subtext here is that you're saying radio's the past and whatever digital media that you're broadcasting on is the future.
Well, actually, that's not the case. I think they thought about us as just old-style radio, which meant all we did was just do what we had always been doing. But today, our broadcast radio stations, which we're very proud of and we build the entire company on, do a lot of interesting stuff. Like we just did the iHeartRadio Music Festival in Las Vegas, which is really all of our radio stations banding together, building and promoting this huge event that, by the way, got about 5 billion social impressions, which is about as much as the Academy Awards gets, and bigger than the halftime show at the Super Bowl. So, when you create something like that, that's, to me, the future, but it's still broadcast radio. It's just that broadcast radio can do so much more. In the old days in broadcast radio, we had a request line, and that was the only way we really communicated real time with our audience. Today, we have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have Twitter, and all these become communication devices for our people on the air to be in touch with the audience on a real time basis in a very rich communication style. So it's what broadcast radio has become today versus 20 years ago, as well as obviously when we think about our broadcast radio stations, we think about the broadcast part of it is just one way to get to the consumer. But I'm sitting here in New York. Z100 is one of our most popular radio stations. And today you can get Z100 on your phone on iHeartRadio. You can get it on your computer. You can get it on your Xbox. You can get it on your Sonos. And so what we've done is we've extended the platform for our broadcast radio stations, understanding that what people love is Z100. They don't really love our transmitter or our tower. They probably don't even know we have one or know where it is. They just know they turn on a device and on comes Z100. And that, to me, is the most important thing. And that's the connection we have. And Elvis Duran in the morning is their friend for so long that they count on and know every nuance of his life.
Although I see that still just less than 5% of the listening to Clear Channel happens digitally. So it does make me wonder whether you're catering, and not just you, by the way, public radio is doing this too, moving towards throwing a lot of effort into new platforms and digital and looking towards the future. But there is that 95% of people who are still listening on the good old-fashioned radio.
And by the way, I think they always will. What we find about digital is not that it replaces the FM radio. I mean, FM radio has better fidelity. It's more convenient. You've got it in your car. You got it next to your desk. You've got it everywhere in your house. But there are places where you don't have it. My wife takes the train in to New York City. It's about an hour ride. And until we had iHeartRadio, she couldn't listen to the radio. Now she can listen to the radio on her phone. So we're able to pick up incidental listening occasions. And although it's 5% of our listening, we actually think it didn't replace other listening. It was this additional listening we picked up. What's wonderful is we finally have a transistor radio in our pocket again, and we can listen to all those occasions and all those places where we could listen to that transistor radio. We now can. We just happen to call it the phone. And by the way, sometimes the phone has an FM chip in it, so you're actually technically listening to the radio, although I think the consumer really doesn't differentiate whether they're picking it up over the internet or over mobile or over FM band. They just have found the station they love and the personality they're friends with.
Are you in favor of FM chips being put in all phones?
Oh, I'm in favor of every place we can get FM. I'm in favor of putting FM chips in people's brains.
Well, but how long do you think people are going to be listening to the radio? Do you think 10 years from now the numbers are going to be very different and people will not be listening to the FM dial at that point?
Well, my favorite statistic is in 1970, about 92% of Americans listened to the radio every week. In 2014, about 92% of Americans listened to the radio every week. Most of it's done to FM, some to AM, and now increasingly the internet as well. But again, as I say, I don't think it's replacement. And I think people are, you know, it's not like TV where people are moving from one form to another, or it's not like music where they're going from the CD to iTunes to Spotify. This is just an additive, a way to get to these stations. They love the stations so much and the people on the radio so much that they look to find them everywhere they can. Why wouldn't you? If we do our job well, it's your best friend. Wouldn't you like to have your best friend with you as many times as you can and as many places?
It's Here and Now, and if you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Bob Pittman. He's the CEO of iHeartMedia. That's the new name of the broadcasting company formerly known as Clear Channel. The company owns more than 850 radio stations in 150 markets around the country, so you've probably heard some of their content.
Z100, number one for new music.
And Nick Jealous is
when you have politically correct mobs, whether it be in the universities or the vermin in the press, who threaten you if you refuse to call what is evil good and what is good evil.
¿Qué pasa con tus artistas favoritos? Muy pronto llegarán a tu ciudad Pitbull y Enrique Iglesias.
Enrique Iglesias. At the end of the day, then good gospel music.
This is the music I live for.
It's the Rush Hour of Power on WHLW FM 104.3.
Some of the content produced by iHeartMedia. And Bob Pittman, you yourself were a radio announcer at the age of 15. What got you into radio?
I always wanted to learn to fly, and I was 15 years old. You can get a student license at 16. So I told my parents, I want to take flying lessons, and they said, good, you better find a job. So I tried a job at a men's clothing store where all the kids hung out after school in this small town in Mississippi, Brookhaven, Mississippi, and they said, no, you're too young. I tried the high-paying job in town, which was bagging groceries at the Piggly Wiggly. There were no jobs available, and I walked in a little radio station. I met the owner, Bill Jones, and said, I want a job, and he said, well, do you have good grades? And I was like, yeah, pretty good, and he said, do you get in trouble? And I said, not really, and he said, well, come in this room. He turned a reel-to-reel tape recorder on, turned it on, pulled out some old teletype paper with news printed on and said, read this news. I read it, and at the end, he listed it and says, okay, that's good enough. Go to New Orleans, get your third-class radio telephone operator's license, and you got a job. And that began my radio career.
And you did move up, and you went on to lead a lot of companies. You were one of the people who led the team that created MTV, which we remember started off with the video of Video Killed the Radio Star. Was that your decision?
It was my decision. It exactly was my decision. Picked the name of the network, picked the first video, and of course the interesting thing is that that was the first video on MTV. And today, music is no longer in the name MTV. They took music off of that, and radio's is as big or better than it's ever been.
But that's pretty aggressive to go in as a radio guy and have them put Video Killed the Radio Star on as the first video.
You got to have something dramatic. Come on. This is you got to have a story.
What is the biggest risk you've taken in your career, do you think?
The biggest risk I've taken in my career. You know, it's funny. I never think of things as risk. I think of them as fun, as opportunities, that I'm a curiosity seeker. And I have this view that people have these plans. They say, oh, that's too scary. That's risky. I'm going to stick with my plan. And I try to explain to them that their plan is actually as risky as the unknown. They just are living with the illusion that they have a plan, that almost nothing comes true in someone's plan, that you're taking a risk anyway. So you may as well just jump in there.
And have you made mistakes in the risks or the plans that you've had over the years?
Oh, gosh, yes. I think mistakes are the byproduct of innovation. I tell our folks here, probably half of the things you do will be wrong. So just be prepared that they're wrong. Change it and change it quickly until you get it right. If it doesn't work, try it again. If that doesn't work, try it again. You can't be afraid of a mistake. I used to work for this wonderful entrepreneur, Steve Ross, who took his father-in-law's two funeral homes and eventually turned it into Time Warner. And Steve used to say, in our company, you'll never be fired for making a mistake. In our company, you'll be fired for not making a mistake. Because if you're not making any mistakes, tells me you're not trying anything new. And these assets we've given you to manage will wither away under your leadership. And I believe that, and I've taken it to heart. And I repeat it often, and I hopefully always give Steve credit.
One of the things that commercial radio has become known for is a lot of very conservative talk radio hosts. And I wonder what you think of that and whether you think that there is balance on the commercial end of the dial.
Sure. Look, I think today there's balance everywhere. We might argue too much balance, that you can find anything you want anytime, almost anywhere. I happen to politically be, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, but I find that I am interested in everybody's point of view. I am actually especially interested in people who think differently than I do because I'm fascinated about how they could come to the conclusion when I have come to the opposite conclusion.
Do you think they go too far sometimes, though?
Well, look, I think I'm not so sure what too far is. I think people are welcome to their opinion. I'm an intelligent human being. I'll decide what I want to believe and what I don't. But I actually want my point of view to be shaped by I've heard all the points of view. What I don't want to do is hear just points of view that are my point of view. And for us to all sit in a room and say, yes, we're smart and nobody else is. And you say, well, do you even know what anybody else is saying? I welcome that. I look for it in my personal life. I think it's very, very healthy. I know there's a bigger debate on the internet than on radio about all these different points of view. But I actually think what we really have to do is make sure people listen to them all and that they get all the opinions. And then I trust human beings. And I think people actually make good decisions. And the more information they have, the better their decision.
So you don't think that sometimes when a talk show host or a political talk show host goes on the air and tells the audience that they ought to do this or that, and then they go and do it, that they're not being creating an issue where there wouldn't have been one before?
No, at all. I think that I give people a lot of credit for having a good brain. And I've never met, at least not the people I know, human beings that when someone tells them to do something, they'll say, oh, yes, I'll go do that. I think people have their own center and their own center of gravity, their own compass. And I think they listen to points of view. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of people listen to people of opposite points of view because they want to hear them and they want to get riled up as much as people listen who share the similar point of view. So I actually think it's very healthy. And I would hate to live in a country where we didn't want that. It's funny. I grew up in Mississippi in the 1960s when the Civil Rights Movement was in full bloom and was really the hotbed of change in the South. And I think, you know, the more points of view you could hear, the better it was. And at that point, the points of view that were being stifled in the South were liberal points of view. So I'm having grown up in that, I'm someone who is a firm believer in free speech and want people to feel encouraged to say whatever they want to say and trust human beings will make the right judgment.
Bob Pittman, the CEO of iHeartMedia, formerly known as Clear Channel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Great fun.
And two members of Congress who grilled Secret Service Director Julia Pearson yesterday about lapses in security, such as the man who hopped a White House fence, are now calling for Pearson to resign. Here's Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings this morning on MSNBC.
I went in hoping to hear news that our president was being properly protected and maybe we were missing something. But when I left, I was just extremely upset. And to be very frank with you, it was very difficult for me to sleep last night.
Also, because after yesterday's hearing, news broke that when the president visited the CDC in Atlanta in September, a subcontracted CDC security guard got on an elevator with the president. That was bad enough, but it turns out he was an ex-con and had a gun. Pearson did not mention this at the hearing, and Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz told Fox News it appears she didn't tell the president either.
She did not tell the president of the United States that a three-time convict with a gun was in an elevator with the president. Secret Service did not know that he had a gun. And I think it's time that she be fired by the president of the United States or that she resign.
Let's check in with Michael Shear of The New York Times. Michael, how did this happen, this elevator incident? You're not supposed to be around the president with a gun.
No, and any of us who've traveled with the president know the security is really, really intense, especially in those times when when they're in a facility or a place that's not right. Already protected, like the White House. And so how that happened is one of those things that I'm sure the members of Congress wanted to ask her about, and she didn't mention it, and it didn't come up.
Well, this was first reported in the Washington Examiner, the Post. Washington Post had some details, and you also report that the guard took out his cell phone and started taking pictures of the president, which kind of alerted people that something was not quite right, and that's when he was detained. And then they found out from CDC officials that he was an armed guard. But, you know, what are the questions, further questions that get raised here? Can Director Pearson, she's been on the job about a year and a half, keep this job?
Well, I think there's two questions, and they're related. One is her future, and that is really a very personal decision up to President Obama, right? Like, this is different than some of the other jobs that maybe the president has hired or fired in the past. This is really affects him more than him personally and his family more than anybody in the country. I think the questions about the incident in Atlanta, what it really raises is the same questions that are raised in some of these other incidents, which have to do with, you know, there are protocols. There are things in place that the agents are supposed to follow that keep the president and the White House secure. And it looks like in many of these cases, those protocols weren't followed. And so the question for the director is how come and what can you do to make sure that in the future such lapses don't take place again.
Look, Pearson was supposed to be coming in to shake up what was perceived as an old boys network with incidents previous to these. But just in case people are wondering, is this extraordinarily different than the past? Has there been a time like this where there have been this many incidents?
You know, I think what the Secret Service would tell you is that there are always every year there are some incidents where people try to pierce the security, what we call the bubble around the president. There are people that come up to the White House all the time. Just this in the last 5 years, there have been 16 incidents where somebody has jumped over the fence at the White House. What distinguishes those incidents from the ones that we've been talking about recently is that in those cases, the person was always stopped very, very quickly. And so I guess the question that the more recent incidents raise is not so much one of are there attempts, but how come they're successful?
Yeah. Michael Shear of The New York Times on these Secret Service security breaches and the call for Director Julie Pearson to step down. Michael, thanks as always.
Happy to do it.
And it's been a rough few months. We probably don't need to remind you about ISIS, Ebola, the turmoil in Ferguson, Missouri. But recently, one of the New Republic's most popular online stories wasn't about any of those things. It was originally published in 1946 by George Orwell. When he wrote it, Orwell called it Politics and the English Language. But when the magazine republished it last month, editors rewrote that headline and made it George Orwell's Brilliant Guide to Writing Well. Along with Orwell, the New Republic has republished a 1933 review of Ernest Hemingway's book Death in the Afternoon, a letter Ray Bradbury wrote in 1977 to a writer who wanted to stop old people from voting, and many more articles. And it's not just the New Republic doing this. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik has noticed more and more news organizations are nestling stories from long ago right in among the news stories of today, both in print and online. David Folkenflik joins us from the NPR studio in New York. Welcome, as always.
Thanks, Robin.
And we should say broadcast has done this forever. Terry Gross has one of the greatest collections of conversations anywhere, and we sometimes love hearing them again. But
sure,
you're right. This is new in print media.
Yeah, I think there's been an interesting thing. I mean, look, if you go to a newsstand, you know, almost any given month, you can feel fairly certain that Vanity Fair people or magazines like those might pull out something and have a cover involving the Kennedys or the royal family.
Right.
This is a little different. You have, you know, legacy news organizations in media criticism. Sometimes you hear the word legacy thrown as an epithet, as though somehow it's a bad thing to have been around for a while. But these news organizations like the New Republic, including others, realize they have just a vast wealth of riches when it comes to content to pull from. If you go to the newsstand now, there's a copy of a magazine from The Atlantic, and it says, The Atlantic presents World War I, How the Great World Made the Modern World. And they do have some essays by modern commentators, but they also have contemporary essays by H.G. Wells, Winston Churchill, Bertrand Russell, the philosopher. They have an interview with Kaiser Wilhelm II. And what they're doing is they're editing, they're curating, they're culling, they're in sometimes compressing material that has imminence as we think about this epical event that happened a century ago that shaped our modern understanding of nation states today. You know, it's on sale for them for 3 months. It's on the newsstand. It's bright and colorful. They sell it for almost twice as much as their usual copies of the Atlantic Monthly. They do 10 times a year. And this is a way for them to shine and remind people of how valuable they are and also to move some product.
But you say even the New York Times says they're doing this. And one wonders, you know, if somebody opens the pages of the New York Times and they miss the headline or a banner and their eye falls on, oh, my God, we're at war with Germany again. You know, the New York Times doing it. Tell us about that.
Well, in some ways, it's a bit more modest. It's a bit more tailored. The New York Times has done two things, one of which is just the ability to search. They've created a kind of machine, they call it, to be able to search visually all of the Times' articles and content prior to, I believe it's 1980. What happened was that when they came in with the web, there was this gap in terms of how far back you would search and how you could search. And they've got a different kind of search than you would do on the website for things in more recent decades. They also have a playful NYT Archives Twitter account in which they tweet things that seem to be enduring, stories that may just pop and be of interest, and also stories that that may have a connection with modern day or today's events. And so readers who want to follow that can sort of be surprised by content that may have a modern purchase, even if it didn't occur to them to go to want to search for it.
So they're not putting it on the pages. Or are they?
You're not seeing that in the same way. You know, The New Yorker does that. Well, they'll occasionally have excerpts of old stories or old fiction run in the margins alongside presentations of other related content. You might see that particularly in themed issues on fashion and other things. But there's something else that's at play too, which is that you're seeing a playfulness involved. You mentioned the headline on the George Orwell story, and it's different now. And why is it different? Well, it's written a lot more like it might appear on BuzzFeed or Upworthy. And that's not entirely by accident. Not only are people smart about these things, but Chris Hughes, who is the creator of the viral website Upworthy, is also the still relatively new owner of the New Republic. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the early guys at Facebook, too. And he understands how people share things. And so, you know, the popularity of the Orwell piece doubled in less than a week. Simply by putting a new, more modern headline on, you know, a decades-old essay about the use of language in politics.
Well, I love it.
Fascinating initiative, I think, on their part.
Yeah, I love reading this stuff. But the papers, I mean, I can imagine an editor thinking, we have such great material. How can we repurpose it? Because it's good. But isn't it also – is this about cost-cutting at papers?
I wouldn't say it's cost-cutting. I think it's ways of trying to generate new revenue at modest cost. It costs something to go back in the archives. For people who care about writing and journalism and literature, it's also a joy. But it costs something to go and call those things. And at the same time, you know, either in most cases, the copyright on these things have lapsed, so they can republish it at no cost or at little additional cost. And also, it's already there, so they can find it. And, you know, they're saying, look, this is content content that has proven the test of time. And the other thing that they're saying is people are more likely – and in some ways they backed into this realization. It wasn't that they set out with this. But people are more likely to spend more time on stories that aren't transient, that aren't about what just happened a moment ago, except for really big stories. They may get enmeshed and engrossed in things that are about themes that play out beyond just the moment in which it was written. And so that's something that advertisers digitally look for, and that's something that subscribers may be more willing to pay for, whether online or in print. And as a result, they think that this can bind readers to them in a more to bind their loyalty, to make them more committed in the way that I think public radio listeners are committed to their local stations and to NPR. I think it's an effort, I think, to try to cement that relationship.
Interesting, because sometimes when you get – by the time you get to the paper, the story is already old and you know that and you skip it. But, you know, we only have about a minute, David. Speaking of cost cutting and this idea of maybe using old material not to have to pay for new, big announcement today from the New York Times that it's going to eliminate 100 jobs just in the minute we have. Your thoughts?
Well, it's troubling. It's a sign of the financial pressures facing even the New York Times. It's a sign that some of their digital applications, paid apps that they've offered, their audiences haven't paid off quite in the ways that they had hoped. They're eliminating one of them, NYT Opinion. But it's also worth noting, you know, they're cutting that from 1,330 newsroom employees. That's more than any other newspaper has on its own in the country. And it's almost an all-time high for the New York Times in terms of levels. To me, at the moment, this looks like ebb and flow. You know, rather than deep gouging of newsrooms as has happened all over the country at other newsrooms. One thing I will say is the fears that presages greater cuts or it presages damage to the core mission journalistically. At the moment, we're not seeing that.
Okay. David Fogenflick, NPR's media correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet.
It was horrific behavior, Sean. It was wrong. I was wrong. But that's all I can do is apologize and pray.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with a, which started as a dear, dear friend.
It is with sadness and deep regret that I announce that it is my intent to resign from the Senate effective September 30th.
While some of the things that have been posted today are true and some are not, there is no question that what I did was wrong. This behavior is behind me. I've apologized to my wife, Huma. And I'm grateful that she has worked through these issues with me and that I've had her forgiveness.
The voices there of Anthony Weiner, Larry Craig, Mark Sanford, and Mark Foley, once powerful politicians admitting to the infidelities that ruined their careers, or at least stunted their careers. Their stories are the subject of a new play that opens today off-Broadway. It is called Tailspin, and it was put together by playwright Mario Correa, who used the actual words these politicians uttered along the way. Mario Correa joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Hi, Jeremy.
Where did you get the idea for this?
You know, I was a staffer back in the Hill, back on the Hill in the 90s, and I knew Mark Foley. He was a guy who was around a lot and came to work with him on some things and got to know him socially a little bit. And I thought his life was so odd that he had this really closeted existence as a politician, but was very out socially in D.C. So I knew I wanted to write a play that sort of talked about a member of Congress who had a double life. And I went to research the transcripts of the Foley scandal for inspiration. And then when I researched them, I realized, you know, there's no way I could write something as crazy as what these guys actually said and have any audience believe it. And that's where the idea came to basically do a play just based on the actual transcripts, police reports, IMs, texts, tweets of the politicians in question.
Well, that's the interesting thing is the words in this play are the words that they actually spoke.
Yeah, every single word in the play, bar none, was actually uttered, tweeted, texted, or even sung by one of these four scandalized politicians.
Sung? They sung it?
Yeah, because, you know, Larry Craig was one of the founding members of the Singing Senators Barbershop Quartet. So we start off the show with him singing to the tune of West Side Story's Maria. He sings, Alito, I just met a judge named Alito. And that really kicks off the show in grand style, as you can imagine.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. And here's a clip from the show where Mark Foley is chatting with one of his congressional pages. Both actors are sitting in front of imaginary computers, and you hear the sound of an instant messenger chime.
How my favorite young stud doing?
Tired and sore.
You need a massage.
Tomorrow we have the first day of lacrosse practice.
Love to watch that. Those great legs running.
Ha ha, they're great.
Well, don't ruin my mental picture.
And I guess we have to cut it off there because it gets too much for NPR. But these are the actual words that they texted each other.
Absolutely. You know, and it's funny because even though it's not like a rated G show, we did have to keep it rated like PG-13 or R so that audiences could actually listen to this stuff, you know. And the kinds of things they said, I mean, will blow your mind. So, yeah, it took a lot of like careful choosing to figure out what audiences wanted to hear from this stuff. And it really gets very racy. And the Mark Foley scene in particular is a challenge because, you know, he was an underage high school page in that scene. And so we treat that carefully. But even so, like the comedy in what these guys actually thought they could say and get away with just blows our minds.
Now, one of the interesting things about this show is that Rachel Dratch, who people remember from Saturday Night Live, she was Debbie Downer, is playing the role of every spurned political wife.
Yeah, every wife, every mistress, every woman who tweeted and texted with Anthony Weiner, and of course Barbara Walters. She made Barbara Walters famous on SNL. Well, I guess she was famous, but
well, and on 30 Rock she played Barbara Walters.
Oh, exactly.
As well. Right.
Oh, yeah, an amazing, amazing impersonation. And so when we had Rachel, which was a real, real gift to our show, it's an incredible. Just gift to have someone of her talent doing this show with us, I realized that she should really be doing all the women's roles. And our director, Dan Konecdis, was the one who made that suggestion. And so now we have her. Every time a mistress comes in, it's Rachel. Every time a wife comes in, it's Rachel. Every time Barbara Walters comes in. And it's partly because, you know, all these women were so expendable in the lives of these politicians, right? They were just like almost a caricature of themselves until you get to Jenny Sanford. So it made sense that one woman would play all of them, and then we finish on Jenny Sanford, who was the woman who basically said, you know what, I'm not going to stand by my man. I am going to basically call him out on this.
You know, some people may see this show and think it's not funny what's going on with these people. This is sad what's happening to these people's lives and careers and their loved ones' lives and careers. Did you have to sort of walk a fine line with that to point out the humor but at the same time see it as a sad destruction of someone's life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and in fact, even though it is a really, really funny show and people are laughing throughout, we do really talk about the humanity of some of these folks and the fact that lives really were destroyed in some cases. You know, going and researching these quotes from these officials, I came across an old Abe Lincoln quote, actually, and he said, I laugh because I must not cry. That is all. That is all. And that's kind of how I feel about the show. You know, we laugh because it is so sad that people in the public eye do this kind of stuff. And this is not sort of to shame the fact that people make mistakes, right? We all make mistakes, and many of us make mistakes in our personal lives. But the case of these guys is interesting because they basically took such immense risks in their personal lives and were often, many of them in the show, big moralizers externally and then doing something else internally. And they did these things because they didn't think the rules apply to them. And you see that thread with a lot of politicians who set the rules for others but don't feel like the rules apply to them. And so that sets up really some of the ironies and I think sort of juxtapositions that the show really tries to demonstrate.
At the same time, just giving them the benefit of the doubt, these are human beings. They make mistakes. They do things that all human beings do. And right. A lot of people see this is one of the big problems of the media is that there's so much focus on these politicians' private lives and not as much on the real issues that matter. We had a president impeached after having an affair.
For sure. And in fact, one of the things that the show does is really also satirize the media who question these guys. So it's called Tailspin, T-A-I-L exclamation mark, because these guys went after the tail and then spin exclamation mark because the media, you know, is then spun by them. So, for instance, we see that in many scenes, Sean Hannity pops up talking to these guys and asking really, really very, very specific and personal questions. He was obsessed with these scandals. And even Matt Lauer, you may remember with Jeremy, Matt Lauer interviewed Senator Larry Larry Craig and his wife
right.
On NBC. And he, Matt Lauer, reenacted the toe-tapping scene in the bathroom. So we have in our show Tailspin, the actor who plays Matt Lauer, Tom Galantich, you know, tapping his foot the way that Matt Lauer did. It's so crazy that the media really also, you know, got so into the thick of it. And so I guess, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around, I think, all of us. And you know, I guess the famous quote, you know, we get the leaders we deserve as well. So the public, I think, we all share in the responsibility.
The play is Tailspin. It opens today off-Broadway. The playwright is Mario Correa. Mario, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.